Hi, everyone. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name's Matt, and my blog is cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and my blog is thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about pairs of movies and sometimes commentaries for single movies. This month, we're doing kind of a special event. It's the Ides of March, and that means we've got March Madness. And, you know, that means it's time to talk about movies relating to the planet Mars. It all kind of connects together. So we're going crazy with Mars movies. This episode, we're talking about the original 1950s sci-fi invading alien classic Invaders from Mars and its 1986 remake. And 2 weeks from now, we'll be coming back to talk about Red Planet and Mission to Mars, which were the two Mars movies that came out within like a week of each other in 2000. So, yeah, Invaders from Mars. I think the last time I saw this was probably when I was as old as, you know, Jimmy, the kid in it. And I loved it. I mean, people have really strong feelings about this movie, and I think I know why. I think it's because it's a movie where the main character is a 10-year-old, but it has this very grave, very serious attitude about what's happening. It's not a kid's movie, per se, even though the main character is a kid and even though the plot is kind of juvenile and everything. It has this intensity to it, which only gets more intense. Actually, no, I'll say it gets less intense when the kid actually confronts the Martians who are invading, but the Martians themselves are really kind of the stuff of nightmares, even though there's these two Martian goons who are just guys in velour suits, but they are led by this creepy green Great Gazoo head in a crystal ball with tentacles, which is a really unnerving, weird effect. And I guess everybody who saw this movie as a kid kind of remembered it, and apparently it was even like re-released throughout the years. The Wikipedia page for this movie has a reissue poster from 1978 where the tagline is "A nightmarish answer to The Wizard of Oz," which is, you know, except for the fact that it doesn't have half as much spectacle as The Wizard of Oz, it is kind of a nightmarish answer to The Wizard of Oz. It really evokes your, you know, a young man's imagination. And actually, what I was thinking about watching it this time around is its similarity to Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
Which hadn't come out yet. But the novel Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Jack Finney only came out in 1954. And this movie was 1953. So I'm not going to say that Jack Finney got the idea from Invaders from Mars. I think it's just one of those coincidental things like RoboCop and The Dark Knight Returns, where people are kind of riding the same sorts of inspiration and happen to create similar works. And it's not like body snatching is the focal point of Invaders from Mars. But at least for the first half, it kind of is. And what makes this movie so strong for a little kid watching it is that the first two people to be body snatched are this kid's parents. And he never really gets them back. No, he doesn't. I mean, he kind of finds like these surrogate parents in the form of a kindly nurse and a kindly friendly neighborhood astronomer who, you know, bring the kid to the military and, you know, help the military launch a counteroffensive. But that was kind of stuck out to me this time around. Not that it's done with any subtlety. Basically, when you're a human who's been, you know, implanted with a Martian mind control chip in this movie, you just become a raging asshole, and it should, be obvious to yourself today.
Yeah. I'd never seen it.
Oh.
Yeah, I'd heard of it, and I'd never seen it. And we talked before a little about the remake, but I'd never seen the original. It just had sort of, you know, I'm not that good on 50s and 60s movies, and this was just one of those examples of things I wasn't that good on. But I'd heard of it, and I'd heard of it as a one of those Red Menace movies.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't have that much Red Menace in it. Certainly not as much as I was expecting. Because all of the brainwashed people have very specific tasks. Almost to the point that, yeah, once they run out of their usefulness, they're killed. Like, and they don't show this, but one of the Jimmy's school friends. Yeah,
Jimmy's a school chum, this little girl, dies off screen. It's pretty harsh.
Yeah, after she sets fire to the house to upset the father or something, and it's... And then you're just, it's really, and then when you realize that the dad hasn't been taken over, like, that's a great scene. So the movie's structured kind of weird. It's 80 minutes. Maybe the first 20 maybe the first 17 is basically introducing you to Jimmy and his family, the change in the family. And then Jimmy, like, running around. His name is Jimmy, right?
I think so. I don't think we're just... no, it's David. He was played by Jimmy Hunt.
Okay, David. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he was... That's why I got confused. But,
not David's... all little kids are named Jimmy.
Not even in the 50s, yeah.
Not even in the 50s.
So David's running around town trying to get help from people, and, like, that's the tensest... Like you said, like how the tension in the movie when it's this kid terrified of being alone and not knowing what to do, that's even more than when he's like fighting the aliens, which is a tense scene at the end when he's fighting the alien, when he's running from the aliens, it's very tense. But, you know, so the first 20 or so minutes is David on his own, because his parents have been... Like, I watched the remake first and then the original, and it's like that whole thing. There's stuff in the original that they never could have gotten away with in the remake. Like, well, the dad beating the shit out of the kid. Like,
yeah, I had a feeling that's what you were thinking of.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten about that too, but in the very first scene where the dad comes home and something's a little wrong and he's like, I'm fine, don't talk to me. And little Jimmy, as we'll call him, is just like, "Are you sure, Dad?" And he just backhands him onto the floor.
And then the mom comes in and sees it. It's like, "Oh, Dad's just in a bad mood. He had to smack Jimmy a little."
Right.
So then he meets up with the kindly doctor, who... believes him pretty much right away, which is the other interesting thing about 50s paranoia. Everybody's just willing to buy into the alien invasion story, like, right away. And then you've got some stuff with her, you meet up with the astronomer, and then you have that really awkward 4 minutes when they're using stock footage of the army mobilizing.
Yeah, it gets a little Ed Woody, towards the middle and the end.
Yeah.
Reused shots and stock footage of tanks that are obviously from somewhere else.
And then the movie also changes because it becomes the army movie. Like, it becomes this, like, adolescent male fantasy that you're...
Yeah, the military is going to mobilize against the Martians. And then it gets kind of boring, like, when the military is storming the underground Martian lair. But you're right, it is the adolescent fantasy. I mean, it's a kid's movie that takes itself dead seriously. And I guess the great thing about it, about the story and the implausibility of it, it's not just that, you know, the kindly, sweet nurse believes David right away, but it's also that, like, this kid mobilizes the military himself, basically. I mean, with the help of the astronomer and the nurse, who are grown-ups, but still, it's like the astronomer also believes him, because he's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, a lot of weird stuff happening on Mars. You're probably right. They probably are invading us right now."
Yeah, and
It reminded me a lot of Japanese monster movies, which like would have their heyday in the 60s, where, yeah, like some little kid is like, Gamera's friend to children, you know, and everybody in the Japanese military listens to some little kid in short pants about what they should do about Gamera.
And a little hat. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that, but yeah, it is like that. It's like whatever that Godzilla movie is where the there's the one Godzilla movie that I've always wanted to see again, and I mean I think I have a copy of it, but it's like the serious one where the little kid imagines that Godzilla, his Godzilla toys grow up and fight for him or something, and he's bullied at school. It's like the 400 blows, but with Godzilla toys. But yeah, so the little kid, it's not just that people believe him. It's that, like, the doctor lady calls her friend. And that's another thing is that, so the guy who directed it, William Cameron Menzies, was mostly, I guess, a production designer or a set decorator.
Yeah.
And so it's got these great sets. They're very, and everybody talks about the sort of surreal, dreamlike quality of the sets. But one of the things that the movie has is it's from the perspective of however old he is, like an 8 or 10 year old. Because there's clearly something going on with the doctor and the astronomer, but it's not really in the kid's worldview yet. So it's like all very subtle and beyond his understanding, which is really kind of cool. But she calls up the doctor and the doctor calls up the astronomer, and you know, she comes out and she tells David, I believe you. After the parents have come in and be like, you know, we're going to sue you, lady. We need to take our son to the sand pit. And she goes, well, I called astronomer blah, blah, blah. And he said, you had your head screwed on right, like you weren't going to make up a story. And so I believe you about this space aliens invading.
Right, right. Yeah, now the production design and the surrealism, it's not – you can't go as far. It's not like Dr. Caligari surreal,
no.
But it's this subtle thing of like he goes into a police station and all the walls are just kind of taller than they should be. And like the clock on the wall is like way up high, like as it would be if you were a 10-year-old looking up at it.
Right.
And it's subtle, but it's there. And yeah, this is the only movie I can ever remember where the opening – where the credit for the director says production design and direction by William Cameron Menzies. Like he was more proud of his production design than his direction, I guess. And it really works. And, you know, ultimately, spoiler alert, the big conceit of this movie is that it was all a dream. So you've got this perfect escape hatch, you know, reasoning for why it has a child's logic to the story. And a child's perspective to the production design. And that's another thing about – and adding to the dreamlike quality is the fact that like this just takes place in small-town America, like any town USA. It's not – it wouldn't have been complicated for them to shoot on location, but I can't even tell if there are any location shots in the movie, like because besides the sets of the homes and the police station and the, you know, observatory and so forth, and certainly the underground tunnels at the end. Even like probably one of the most famous images in the movie is the kid's view of his backyard from his bedroom window. It's of this hill and this winding fence that goes over the horizon, and over that horizon on the other side of the hill is this sand pit where the Martians are and where people are getting sucked down and implanted with mind control. And that image of the hill horizon like became so iconic that it's on the poster for the 80s remake, and they pretty much duplicate it exactly. They duplicate a lot of the production design, but we'll get to that. Yeah, all that artificiality just kind of adds to the otherworldliness and the unreality of it, and it's really nice.
Yeah, it's I've heard or I read some people saying that the end of it, when you got to this alien spaceship somehow compared to the beginning sort of surrealism. And it really doesn't, because, you know, an alien spaceship can look like anything. But the stuff at the beginning that he does, sort of warping reality to make it fit the expectations of a scared little kid, you know, there's a lot more frame of reference for the viewer.
Yeah.
It's like really cool. And I mean, this guy had been working on movies since 1919 or earlier. So clearly he knew what he was doing. I mean, reading the trivia on IMDb, they're like, yeah, like his first amazing thing was in 24 with The Thief of Baghdad. And then, you know, his direction career was problematic because he couldn't direct actors, which would explain the mother's performance in this.
Performances aren't the best, but hey, guess what? That stiltedness adds to the dreamlike quality. You can't go wrong when your movie takes place inside a dream.
Yeah, and I think that, obviously the Colonel guy who's very familiar, Morris Ancrum. I was like, oh, is he going to be a lead in this? Because, you know, he's in a lot of stuff. I just can't remember what else I've seen him in, because he's, you know, he's a 40s and 50s character actor. But he's really good. I mean, you know, that's kind of the hard part of, we'll talk about this in the next one, that the army guy has to be able to sell the idea that they believe this kid.
Yeah, they don't have any Godzilla movies to reference for how they should be approaching that.
Yeah, and I mean, he sells it, and I mean, the other guy, the astronomer's a little stilted, but, you know, the doctor's fine, but she's really only in it. Like, she only has stuff to do for, like, 20 minutes at the most, because, you know, the second half of it, if it's not stock footage or armies mobilizing, it's the chase scene through the alien stronghold, which is really kind of cool, because, you know, I saw the remake first. I'd read about when we decided on this one, we debated whether or not to watch this version or the British version, which was actually done, you know, they shot new scenes for it because they thought the British wouldn't be able to understand it, I guess. Whatever. Okay. So I basically knew what the ending was going to be, but there's this scene where the kid's trying to get out is still very tense. And it's like that classic countdown clock. It's a very early countdown clock is what it is. It's the Bond ending, you know, however many years before James Bond.
Yeah, I mean, doctor lady, I keep wanting to call her the nurse, the school nurse, because that's what they made her in the remake. But the doctor lady does kind of disappear for a while, but then she shows up importantly at the end because David's trying to rescue her. She's got, you know, there's this long phallic needle slowly getting closer and closer to going inside her neck. And I try not to be too Freudian in my analysis of anything, but they definitely are these kind of surrogate parent figures. And the fact that she's kind of like this kindly older lady, like old enough to be his mom, and who kind of takes over for his mom in this dream is a weird thing. That combined with the phallic mind control needle. Oh, and also that, like, you know, she's wearing this 50s outfit, which is very conservative. But then when she's captured by the alien, they, you know, tear off one half of it so that she's just got this one bare shoulder exposed. And it's like, was that for the dads in the audience or what?
Well, you talked a little about the evil alien man at the end. So the interesting thing about Invaders from Mars, and this is why it didn't, the Red Menace thing didn't really, I don't see it as much. I mean, I see it a little at the end, but not that much, is that the Martians are coming to Earth because, very specifically, they live in, like, motherships surrounding Mars, and they don't want us to find out about it.
Right, because Earth is starting to launch satellites into space.
Yeah.
And on top of that, there's this scene which probably drove more than a few anti-war beatniks and hippies crazy when they saw this in the 50s and 60s, where the good guy astronomer is explaining how it's going to be so awesome that we're going to have death lasers in space that can obliterate entire countries that try to mess with America.
That was kind of cool, because I'm sitting there watching it going like, dude, it's Star Wars! Dude!
Right, it's the Star Wars program.
And it's real genius!
Yeah, and he's also saying, like, that's why we're being invaded by Mars, because they don't want us to have, you know, death rays in space. And it's like, that makes me kind of sympathetic to the Martians. Now it's kind of like the day the Earth stood still, where the alien comes to tell us that we're getting too big for our britches with all of our atomic weaponry, and, you know, consider this a warning and all that. It's definitely not a Red Scare movie, and you can't really read it as such. I don't know. It's definitely in the context of the Cold War and the burgeoning atomic age, because it does reference all that stuff.
Yeah, and then, well, the thing that I found interesting, and they never really go into anything, and that's kind of – I did want to mention that – They save the parents, right? Mm-hmm. The cops save the parents, or the army saves the parents. And so the doctor lady tells Jimmy, she's like, so your parents, they've got them and they're going to operate on them. And he's like freaking out. He's like, what? They don't have an hour. They're going to fry their brains and all this stuff. And that goes nowhere, because it's a dream sequence. And it's like, that has more tension. It returns the movie to that sort of realistic tension.
Mm-hmm.
And the
initial trauma of what's going to happen to my mom and dad.
Right. My mom and dad are now, like, not only have they been possessed by aliens, but now they've been saved. But wait, the doctor, you know, his car could break down. And they totally get rid of that. And I was really hoping they wouldn't. Especially because when Jimmy wakes up from his dream, his parents are, well, you know, he's all right. Leif Erikson's really likable. The mother, not so likable. I mean, even when she's not possessed.
Yeah.
But the thing I wanted to say was the Globehead guy.
Yeah. Gazoo.
Is that his name?
Well, no, but he does look like the Great Gazoo from the Flintstones.
There's a comic.
If you've never seen the film.
If you have.
That's a visual idea. Gazoo with tentacles.
He makes some comment about how, like, he's the natural evolution. And it's like, it's this weird implication that Martians are people and shit. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's weird.
The genealogy of the Martians in this is weird, because they do, yeah, they say that. And then they say that the two velour-suited goons who do the grunt work for the Great Gazoo Head are mutants.
And I think that's got to be the first use of mutant in something.
Right. Because they didn't know how to say it. they didn't say it as we do. Yeah, they're mutants. And they're humanoids, obviously. But yeah, with the whole Martian leader being the most evolved and human intelligence, we're just left to assume that his goons are like humans who had their DNA fiddled with to be green-skinned slaves, basically.
And then, of course, you know, the ending is a dream, except it's all a dream, except it does end with the spaceship landing again.
Yeah,
this is
like the original "It was all a dream, or was it?" ending.
Yeah.
It's one of the classic examples of that where, yeah, you wake up from your stupid dream and then it's actually happening.
So
prepared now.
Or something's happening. Yeah. Yeah. It's very obviously. Okay. So it was independently produced and I guess Fox picked it up and released it in 1953. And Fox, of course, also did The Day the Earth Stood Still, which was 50...
I think it was 54.
One.
Oh, it was 51?
Yeah. I think it was 51. Day the Earth Stood Still was...
Yeah, you're right, 51.
51. So, I mean, clearly they were trying to... You know, it was a studio branding sort of thing, is that they were going to do the sci-fi, and you know, it's if you forgive the use of stock footage that was undoubtedly it's bad use. I mean, it's like it is Ed Woody. I mean, it's like they got fake dialogue in these scenes. Some of them are colored for day for night. I mean, it's just like. Why is this scene still going on? Are we going to see all these tanks? And then, yes, you do. You believe that the tanks are coming through to blow this shit up. But it's really cool. And, I mean, it's...
Yeah. It's interesting that between 51 and 53, like Day the Earth Stood Still in this movie, that's kind of like the definitive sea change between... the trend of science fiction movies being, I don't know, Ray Bradbury-esque, thoughtful, moral parables and a lot of the other Mars movies that we could have chosen from for this episode, like Devil Girl from Mars, say, or Mars Needs Women, or a lot of other titles that kind of say it all about how campy they are. So... Yeah, I mean, again, not that this movie doesn't take itself seriously. It absolutely does. But at the same time, it's, I guess, you know, visually and the hook of Martians as evil invaders just kind of struck a chord with people because, and then, you know, the 50s Cold War and the Atomic Age, I guess you're just not going to – you're not going to have too many other Klaatu, Barada, Nikto kind of hey, knock it off with the atomic weapons. I mean, I think after Invaders from Mars, after everybody saw Invaders from Mars in 53, people, you know, movie producers were like, no, people want to see movies where, you know, the Martians mess with us and then we kick their ass.
Yeah, it's
a tradition which reached a loving epoch with epochs. No, a loving, there's a love letter to this kind of movie and it's called Mars Attacks. And I wish we could have included that somehow, but Mars Attacks is just amazing. And it's certainly inspired by movies like this one.
Yes. And it's too big for just, well, especially the, you know, with Mars Attacks, the thing that you always, the easiest thing to, carryover is of course the Pierce Brosnan's idiot scientist, because all these movies have an idiot scientist who explains everything, and in these movies they're right, like the guy who explains the mutats, and you know he knows that they're living in motherships, you know, and he's like, oh no, Jimmy, you're going to be a good astronomer someday just like me, and it's just like yeah. The other one thing I did want to talk about was the sand pit.
Yeah. And the music, the sand pit theme, which is
like
a choir of really weird atonal voices. It's one of the creepier nightmare inducing things in the movie. Is that that chanting music when people get sucked down under, like, you know, graboids have them or something.
Yeah. And also just the visual of the sand pit, because the hill is clearly a set, like you said before. But there are a couple shots where Jimmy's looking through his telescope. And man, those shots are freaky. because
it's people like off in the distance getting sucked down under.
It's people off in the distance getting sucked down, and you're like, is anybody gonna believe Jimmy?
Yeah.
Luckily, and that's kind of, yeah, and luckily everybody does, but even after people are believing him, you're still like, oh shit, is anybody gonna believe him about this latest one? Yeah. And that's like the greatest strength is that Invaders from Mars, it's able to keep up the tension even after.
Yeah, even after it gets into the tediousness of the military mobilizing. And one more thing about that, I think it's kind of interesting from a cultural historical perspective that part of, and this, you know, you see this in Invasion from the Body Snatchers. You go to the police and, oh no, the police are also already having been taken over. But it never seems to occur to anyone, or they never suggest a problem of the military getting taken over by the invaders.
Not even when a general is brainwashed. There's a general brainwashed in this one, and he turns into basically a terrorist, yet the colonel is able to, like, call the Pentagon up and be like, oh, yeah, they got General – what's his name here? Hold on. General Mayberry. They got General Mayberry. And I was expecting them to give the colonel, like, additional powers. But no, they were just, you know, you're going to have to take care of it, dude. You're going to have to arrest the general.
Right. So, yeah, kind of a, you know, local state government isn't as trustworthy and reliable as the good old U.S. Army sort of message.
Yeah.
Not that this is a jingoistic, propagandistic movie. It really isn't. It's just kind of like indicative of the way people felt in society at the time. Just a lot of shared assumptions about America's place in the world and power and all that.
Yeah.
So not a Red Scare movie per se, but certainly a document of the time in which it was made. So
yeah, it's a cool one.
Yeah. And that's not something that you could say about the remake, that it's a document of its time, because it's a throwback. And you see this poster of a hill, and you're just like, what? You know, I Invaders from Mars sounds interesting. I like the font of the logo, but what's this hill jazz? And that kind of just tells you that, like, this was a nostalgia project. I mean, reading up on the trivia, apparently Spielberg was considering directing this remake because, you know, just like Toby Hooper, the guy who did end up directing it, it's like a movie that affected a lot of guys from that generation when they saw it as kids. And apparently it was like this huge bomb and you know, everybody hated it. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I think it's pretty good. I mean, it's not great, but it's like, it's a fitting tribute to the original at the very least.
Yeah, and I mean, it's – well, I'm just – I'd never seen it.
You saw it first without having seen the original.
Right.
So you were going in about as even-keeled as you could be.
Yeah, and we have watched not that recently, but we watched Return of the Living Dead for the podcast, and we did watch Poltergeist recently. And so Invaders from Mars in some ways is, it's like a proto Mars Attacks. It's like Mars Attacks without any money.
Yeah.
Because O'Bannon and Jacoby are, they're like doing a comedy.
Yeah.
And Hooper, at the beginning at least, I really think the scenes establishing the family at the beginning of this one is Hooper going, dude, I fucking directed Poltergeist. Leave me alone. Like, look,
yeah.
Here's a naturally occurring family. Isn't it magical?
Right. Here's a warm family who loves each other.
Yeah, okay. I can do that, all right? Do you notice that yet? Okay. And then he sort of moves away from that. And I mean, yeah, it's got, I mean, you know, it's got aliens at the end that are like, biting each other and laughing at stupid humans. It's funny, you know? I mean, the whole thing is played for, I mean, it's James Karen's hilarious as the army guy. You know, Bud Cort shows up for a second.
James Karen's character, he's like the military leader. He's about as close to Mars Attacks territory as the movie gets. Because the movie's not being like ironic or, you know, in spoofing sci-fi cliches, and it's not trying to like just randomly include sci-fi cliches for the fun of it. But it's taking all the elements from the original Invaders from Mars, which were very, you know, raw base elements, and, you know, doing them with a slight tongue-in-cheek, a little humor, but also maintaining the integrity of, you know, the boy's terror, you know, David Gardner's terror at what's happening. And Tobe Hooper actually, he never gets credit for this, but he's damn good with child actors. And it's not just Poltergeist or this. Like, you look at some of his, like, weird offbeat movies, like the follow-up to Texas Chainsaw, Eaten Alive with Neville Brand. It's like there's a little girl in that, and he's just good at handling kid actors. And I didn't even know until reading up on this movie for this episode that Hunter Carson was Karen Black's son. Karen Black takes
really?
Over.
Really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Karen Black takes over for the kindly woman doctor role, except in this they make her the school nurse, which kind of simplifies some plot stuff. And Hunter Carson's real good, actually.
Yeah, he's the kid from Paris, Texas, and his dad is L.M. Kid Carson, who co-wrote Texas Chainsaw, so it just all sort of wraps in on itself as far as connections to other podcast episodes. No, yeah, Karen Black, and I think this has got to be our first Karen Black movie for the podcast. She's, by the time this had happened, by 86, her career as a serious actor had sort of stopped. And I would assume that's because they kept rerunning Trilogy of Terror for years and years, and that's all people could see. I mean, you know, she has a very distinctive look. Like, she's very memorable looking. And I think the Trilogy of Terror just being rerun year after year in the 80s sort of got in the way of the fact that, you know, for the 70s, you know, she was in a lot of great movies. Like,
yeah, she's amazing in Five Easy Pieces, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Five Easy Pieces.
She's
Nashville.
Amazing. She's incredible in Day of the Locust.
Yeah.
So, they obviously Canon was able to get her for cheap, and she would have been working at Canon otherwise.
And you got to feel kind of bad that she got downgraded to a nurse, but from a doctor. So she's really, I didn't realize she was the mom, but the funny thing about the remake is that most of the problems the original has, the remake has. Halfway through the movie, they reveal there's a mission to Mars about to happen that nobody's heard about before that. It's kind of a problem. It would have been nice to know in the setup, especially in the remake, because the remake has a like newscast opening where they could have very easily said, yeah, there's this rocket ship that's going to go to Mars. Get ready for that.
Well, in both movies, David Gardner's – well, he's not David Gardner in the original, is he? Anyways, in both movies, the kid's dad works at NASA.
Right.
And it's not NASA yet in the 50s, but it's NASA in 86. And that's kind of why the aliens would want to control him, is to have a mole in there. But yeah, it does kind of come out of nowhere still. And they actually do – they try to telegraph the military stuff that's going to come later, because they mention James Caron's character, General Wilson, once or twice in dialogue before he pops up. But but what I'll say in its defense is that I think, you know, probably just by virtue of having a larger budget, even by Canon, actually especially by Canon standards, watching the military guys mobilize and run through the tunnels and shoot at aliens and stuff is more entertaining than it is in the original. And partially because you have these ridiculous-looking Stan Winston-designed aliens that are just – instead of the green-skinned mutants from the original, you just have these giant puppety things that are all teeth and giant mouths. And
it looks like the – it looks like they're like a half spoof of a Gamorrean guard or something. Like, I think that that's where the – spoofy humor comes out is with them, and also with the whole idea that the aliens are there for copper, including pennies, which is sort of different than the original. But then the remake has a lot of location shots, and I was thinking about that when you said that earlier, is that whereas the first one has all these exquisite sets, the remake for the first half emphasizes its locations, like the small town locations, mm-hmm. people driving
There's a school where a lot of action takes place.
Yeah, and in the second one, and I think that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is a really good reference because the remake is made after Invasion of the Body Snatchers and at least one remake. Yeah, the 78 remake. Whereas the first one's before all of it. And so in the remake of Invaders from Mars, they're just taking people wholesale. They are, you know, school trips. Everybody's going out to the sand pits. And the aliens' final purpose is never really...
Yeah, it's never really explained. But I think also the movie benefits from having, you know, been made post two different versions of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, because they handle the body snatching stuff with a lot more subtlety. And it's Timothy Bottoms, you know, when he's the dad, and when he comes in and he's all weird, it's good stuff. Like it's as good as the 78 Invasion, because it's that middle ground between something's definitely off and they're kind of stilted, but not so much that they couldn't pass for normal if someone wasn't paying attention.
Right. Like, and I was expecting this in the original, was Timothy, there's this great shot of Timothy Bottoms just drinking this cup of guzzling a hot steaming cup of coffee. And it's like, it's really creepy. And I think that in some ways the remake pushes it a little. Like the kid would be freaking out.
Yeah, like when he watches his mom, Lorraine Newman, pour salt onto raw hamburger meat and eat it. his reaction is a little understated to that, perhaps.
Yeah. And he's like, no, I gotta go to school. Like, I can't hang out with you guys today. I can't go up the hill. And that is one difference, is that they don't refer to it in the original as the hill, even though Jimmy Hunt, the original Jimmy, or David, shows up and is like, I haven't been up here since I was a kid. And the joke is that, you know,
it's
obviously.
Him. Yeah,
it's him. Let's get the dream sequence out of the way.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just get that done now.
It's the only thing I actively dislike about this remake is it emulates the original's ending where it was all a dream, or was it? But it ends it on this incredibly nasty note where Jimmy is left screaming at something that we don't see, and then it ends. And then to add insult to injury, like the music that plays over the credits is this soft, serene, everything's going to be okay now music.
Right. Yeah, it's
like something happened there. I mean, I don't know if Golan Globus said that had to happen or what, like they were trying to set it up for the sequel, but yeah, it's an awful, awful last minute of the movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it comes after this really nice, it's like Lorraine Newman's nicest scene, because she has the problem of only being in it as a regular person for a little bit, and there's this whole subplot about how she's back in school, and it's really, that's when I'm really like, oh, Hooper's just going, dude, I can fucking do family. Like I said earlier, it's like, you know, I can do, you know, this little kid telling his mom she's got to do her homework because she's in college. Like, what's up with that? Like, yeah, Steven Spielberg, show me how to do that. Like,
yeah,
I'll pour you a tumbler of wine at the, you know, table in Jaws. You know, like, we could deal with this. I mean, yeah, it really does feel like that.
He does all this, right. He does all that great stuff, and then it kind of just feels crumpled up and thrown away because of that last 30 seconds.
Yeah, and I mean, there's
pretty unfortunate.
Yeah, and even if you were going to do a dream sequence and you were going to mimic it, it's just, what's he screaming at? Like,
yeah.
What?
Why Why be so mean-spirited about it? Like, he sees something horrible is clearly happening to his parents because he ran to his parents' room. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know what else needs to be said about that, really. It's just unfortunate.
I do wish I knew if they did have, like, a sequel contract signed with Hunter Carson. Like,
I don't know, because actually you can read the second draft of O'Bannon and Jacoby's script online, and it does end exactly the way the original ended, with, you know, just looking out the window and, like, oh my gosh, it's all starting to happen again. So probably wasn't O'Bannon and Jacoby's idea to do that, and I can't imagine that Hooper would want to do something. I'm guessing it was forced at the last minute because the music in the end credits tells you that everything's okay, and
right.
You know,
and
Hooper wouldn't deliberately, you know, fuck with you like that. So,
yeah. There is one thing we need to talk about a little is Louise Fletcher.
Sure. Well, speaking of, you know, the tongue in cheek stuff, Frog in Mouth is probably, whenever you hear this movie referenced, which you barely do, but it seems like – I think I've heard this movie referred to twice in film criticism, and like both times it was referencing – and then you have Invaders from Mars where Louise Fletcher eats a frog. Like that seems to be the main thing that people took from this movie,
now,
the casual moviegoers took from it.
Yeah, let's talk about how people do after they work with Jack Nicholson.
They're ruined. They're just
It's I wonder if Karen Black and Louise Fletcher ever got together, but probably not, because Karen Black's at least dignified in Invaders from Mars, whereas Louise Fletcher, it's like she must have known it was a joke, and they told her, and she just couldn't pull it off. And
yeah,
a lot of it relies on her, because it's a lot like the first one in that there's no astronomer in the second one to explicitly lay out the Martian's plan or anything. It's all more subtle than that. And you find out basically that Louise Fletcher's evil school teacher, who I guess was evil even before she was body snatched, is the one who was the first one taken, like even before David's dad, because she was out there getting the frogs for them to dissect, which is kind of cruel and disgusting, and it made me rethink my entire science class as a kid. Like, did my science teacher go out there and, like, go, like, you're a good frog to kill? Let's get you. Like, I mean, it was like, I know that didn't happen. They got them from a lab, and they were all, like, euthanized with ether or some shit. But, you know, I mean, it's like this creepy scene, because she's, like, really – and the scenes with her and Karen Black where, you know, Louise Fletcher's like, you've got to give me this kid. And Karen Black's like, what the hell are you talking about, lady? Like, there's some of the – even though there's no trippy set design – those are the scenes where it's the most surreal. Like, wait, has reality, like, turned on its head that there's a chance that, like, you know, some school nurse would turn this kid over to this psychotic, you know, obviously psychotic teacher. She, like, dances with the aliens. They eat her at the end. And when they do, they laugh at her. And you're just like, okay, so clearly this was all supposed to be a joke about, and I mean, that's where it gets sort of Mars Attacks-y, because the end of Invaders from Mars, the remake, is probably twice as long as the end in the original.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the remake is not that long either. The remake's only...
it's an hour 40, and the original
it's an hour 40. So, yeah, there's like 22 minutes added on. Most of that is, I would say, what, 15 minutes of it? It's probably at the end.
Yeah.
It feels like. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, the military assault on the Martians. They even go all out and so far as to have, like, the Martians – well, actually, what they bring back from the original is that the Martians want to sabotage a rocket that's going up.
Yeah, they bring that back.
That's not described as the sole purpose of their mission, whatever it is. But yeah, they bring it back, and then they even blow up a miniature rocket. I mean, they spent some money on this movie. And that's the thing that always struck me funny about the three movies that Tobe Hooper made for canon in the mid-80s is that they gave him some money because the guy had just made Poltergeist, you know? They were like, yeah, let's bank on Hooper here. And, like, all three of them were flops, but they all look great. they all have really great production design and art design and everything else.
Yeah, and he sort of got them done. So the three movies are Life Force, Invaders from Mars, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Life Force has a cult following.
Yeah,
Invaders from Mars doesn't. Yeah,
getting a re-release later this year.
And Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 has I wouldn't even call it a cult following. I mean, it has a big following, and it has since.
Yeah, but not at the time. Oddly enough, at the time, you know, fans of the original were like, "What's this crap? You know, why are you doing it as a campy comedy this time around?" But now people are so used to that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that it actually got a new. It got a relatively early re-examination. Like, I'd say, what, like 90, 91?
People
were already like, hey, Texas Chainsaw.
Video, what I understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really turned around, whereas Invaders from Mars never did, and Life Force took a long time. And I think Life Force is one of those ones where people have half memories of it and. You know, it's like a return to a thing. And yeah, he lucked out because Canon bombed out. I was just reading about this with some article about Masters of the Universe 2 versus how Masters of the Universe 2 eventually became that
Cyborg movie,
but it was also Spider-Man.
They were going to do a Spider-Man movie, and Tobey Hooper was possibly going to direct it.
And it all fell apart basically after Superman, which was 87. So Tobey Hooper got, like, them at their most ambitious budget-wise. So he really lucked out. And, I mean, like, you watch the you're watching the evil head guy in the remake.
Yeah, who's gone from a great gazoo head with tentacles into something more resembling Krang from Ninja Turtles, the living brain.
Or also the stomach from Total Recall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing I thought.
Stan Winston, we should mention, designed the monsters.
Stan Winston did the monsters. John Dykstra did the visual effects. I mean, it's slick, and it's Hooper hiring Spielberg guys. It's really weird.
Essentially, yeah.
And then, of course, Christopher Young's score, a lot of it sounds very much like Jerry Goldsmith's Poltergeist, especially the ending.
I like his score for this a lot, actually.
I do too, yeah.
It's the warm stuff is warm the way that Goldsmith's music was in Poltergeist, and then he just does well. I guess another thing adding to the tongue-in-cheek tone of the movie is Chris Young's music when the military guys are marching around, because it's kind of like a tongue-in-cheek military march, like this very dun 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 kind of stuff. Oh, and another big Mars Attacks moment is. We kind of get a proto Pierce Brosnan moment from Mars Attacks in this, because it's Bud Cort.
With Bud Cort. Yeah.
Yeah. attempting to peacefully approach one of these goon aliens who's just a giant mouth full of teeth. And it's like, why would you ever approach one of these things with open arms, let alone try to reason with it? But he does. And this big mouth doesn't even chomp him. It just, like, shoots its death ray at him. And thing from another world moment, the Howard Hawks original.
It's a very weird mix of the casting and then the mood. Okay, so James Caron sort of provides this connection to something like Return of the Living Dead, whereas it's like, okay, Return of the Living Dead was sort of, you know, the zombie comedy, whereas Invaders from Mars sort of the alien comedy with, you know, but the 50s aliens. And I mean, yeah. if this wasn't successful in 1986, what the hell made Warner Brothers think, you know, 11 years later, they were going to be able to make a fortune off it with Mars Attacks? But anyway, but then the casting's totally, you know, weird too. You've got Bud Cort in it. I mean, it's like, you've got Bud Cort, you've got Timothy Bottoms, who is like third build in this, but it's...
Yeah, Lorraine Newman is the mom.
It's almost it is a big reunion of Altman people from the 70s. And I mean, it's just this very strange, in a lot of ways, it makes Louise Fletcher the odd woman out, because, I mean, Lorraine Newman too, because she's newer, but I mean, Bud Cort, Karen Allen, and Timothy Bottoms are very, you know, they're 70s film icons. And they're coming back for Invaders of Mars, which does not fit at all with the spoof aspect. So you have like two different things going on at once. Even, you know, two meta things going on at once without even getting into that it's a remake of Invaders from Mars. And it's just like,
yeah.
And it's from canon. And it's, they must have just told Tobe Hooper, hey, you can do whatever you want as long as it's called Invaders from Mars. Or something.
Yeah, but,
like,
but what's funny is that it's like, so I said this already, but it's such a tribute to the original, and it was obviously like made with a lot of affection for it, and not just because they bring back Jimmy Hunt as a cop, or because they have the great Gazoo globe sitting on a shelf in the background in one scene.
Yeah,
like the story structure is pretty much identical. All these scenarios are identical, right down to, you know, Karen Black has a big needle inching closer and closer to the back of her neck and stuff like that. And actually looking at the O'Bannon Jacoby second draft, they were going to try to do something slightly different with the structure. They were going to play off the fact that it was a dream more, basically, by having, like, when the movie would open with Karen Black and Hunter Carson going to meet James Karen. And James Karen would be like, well, what the heck's going on? And then they would start to tell a story in flashback, which would go back to, you know, seeing the saucer land. Mm-hmm. And then it would come double back to the military for the end of the movie. Well, actually, no, there would be a flashback within a flashback, because there's also the flashback of Hunter Carson explaining to Karen Black everything that's happened so far. So they were playing off of that, and then I got streamlined, and they made it just straightforward. You know, events in the remake happen in the same order that they happen in the original. But that's another kind of campy, I won't say campy, again, tongue-in-cheek aspect of the tribute that they're doing, which is that and James Karen plays it up even more. When they go to meet James Karen at the military base, James Karen is like, oh, you're Timothy Bottoms' kid. Yeah, well, have a seat. You know, tell me what's going on, and then believing what he says with complete credulity. So they kind of acknowledge the silliness of the logic there more than they did in the original, which was not at all.
Yeah, it's and the aliens are a lot more detailed, and it gives the kid a lot more to do on his own.
Yeah, that's one of the things I feel like is an improvement from the original, is that, yeah, the kid doesn't have to defer to the adults halfway through like he did in the original. It's still the kid's story all the way through. Up to the fact that he reunites with his parents at the end.
He does, yeah. And
reunion scene, and, you know, he removes the mind control things from their necks, and it's like, Mom, Dad, you know, you're safe. And then that feels like something in hindsight where it's like, yeah, why wouldn't they put that in the original except to make it more traumatic for kids watching? And of course, the last 30 seconds of the remake doubles, triples any potential for trauma for watching this. Oh, but that's something else I wanted to ask you is like, what? Who do you think? I guess the movie was made. They were probably hoping that parents who loved the original would take their kids to. Because it's certainly. It's
yeah,
kind of,
I remember this. I actually remember this. So I would have been 1986. What? When did it? Came out in June of 1986. I have like vague memories, so I would have been, God, seven. I have these vague memories of my dad seeing the poster or something and mentioning to me the original. Was I really seven? Wait, 78 to 86. Hold on. This is really bad math. Sorry, everyone. Yeah, I would have been seven. So I have like this vague memory of my father talking to me about the original and being excited for the remake, which makes me wonder what people were saying before it came out. Because, you know, Toby Hooper would have been still on a high point. People would have been like, oh, no, Life Force was just, it was a misstep. You know, but this is the guy who made Poltergeist. And, you know, Dan O'Bannon was still okay. Nobody knew Golan Globus was going to suck as bad as they did. And then, right, it came out. It bombed out. Nobody liked it. And then everybody sort of forgot about it. But 2 years later, what got remade too? The Blob.
The Blob, yeah.
So it's like, this was a period where, and The Blob, on the other hand, was rated hard R. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is PG, right? Yeah, it's PG. So I mean, it's yeah, you can, you know, it's Invaders from Mars is a remake that still is trying to incorporate the original viewing audience, whereas The Blob is sort of dismissive of the original viewing audience. And yeah. I'm not, and you know, we've talked about, we're going to do The Blob someday. We just haven't got it scheduled yet. And I liked The Blob remake. So like, yeah. So it's like, I'm not trying to say anything shitty about it. I'm just saying that with Invaders from Mars, there was the aspect that people, yeah, exactly like you said, I like this as a kid. I'm going to take my kids to it now. Whereas with The Blob, it was like by 2 years after this, maybe even based on the failure of this, people were like, we're not going to do that anymore. It's time to be grim and gritty too.
Yeah, actually the failure of this probably had a large hand in deciding to make The Blob remake a hard R.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand the hate for the Invaders from Mars remake. I mean, people were really harsh on this then. They all kind of ganged up on it and, you know, now it's dismissed or, you know, kind of forgotten at best. This is so much better than so many other movies of its kind from the 80s or otherwise.
Exactly. And I mean, it's kind of like, I can't imagine this being on USA Up All Night. It's too good for that. Like, you couldn't do it. Right. And that's a good, stick for movies from the late 70s and the 80s is that, you know, if USA Up All Night could, you know, ravage it, that's a problem. But this is way too classy for that. I mean, it's one of the classiest canon movies. And I actually think most of the classy canon movies probably came from this time before they ran out of money when they were still trying to, be a place where people like Toby Hooper might want to, like, what if this had been a hit and, you know, Cannon would have wanted to keep Toby Hooper around.
Right.
Yeah, it's really too bad. And it's not like. Well, I just feel like you said, at the time people ganged up on it and sort of, you know, knocked it down. But they did such a good job that nobody even thinks about it anymore. It's forgotten, whereas a lot of other stuff gets reexamination. And I'm hoping with what are the Shout Factory guys?
Yeah, the Scream Factory label.
Yeah, maybe Scream Factory label will pick this
up.
I'm
hoping so too. Yeah. I mean, I assume that they, you know, were looking when they were looking at a list of movies that they could buy the rights to, that this was right next to Life Force. So
you would assume, yeah. I mean, so.
But yeah, but like you said, Life Force already had its cult, and Invaders from Mars has just been totally forgotten. So
now, I haven't seen Life Force, but I'm assuming that it's not that. Is it any good?
It has its it has its moments, but that said, I don't like it as much as I do this.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm looking at canon, and basically, yeah, it's just like we said that. Wow, they did a bunch of fairy tales musicals. Okay, didn't know that, but those have not been rediscovered. So. Yeah, Hooper was just there for the right time, because Runaway Train, which would have been the biggest canon movie in terms of critical acclaim, was 85, same as Life Force. Street Smart was their attempt at doing Street Smart and Barfly were their attempts at doing, you know, adult dramas.
Socially relevant, yeah.
Right, and those were 87, and then it all fell apart after that. You know, Salsa and Kinjite. Superman 4, Masters of the Universe, it goes on and on. Oh, but they did distribute Appointment with Death, but I'm pretty sure they didn't produce that. That was one of those Ustinov, Agatha Christie's. Yeah. But, yeah, so it's just like Hooper got in sort of at the right time to make some good movies, but not to really have any good support.
But not good movies that made money, unfortunately. Yeah, no, his career was – the three movies he made with Cannon, like, kind of ended his career in people's eyes. And ironically, they're, like, three of his best movies. And I guess my only theory on why people ganged up on this and nobody went to see it is – it might have just been because there were too many movies of this type coming out at the time. I mean, this was like the Spielberg era, and for a movie about a kid battling aliens to come out in 86, people were probably rolling their eyes and being like, "Yeah, okay, there's like five more of those coming out this summer, and why should we go see one that was directed by Toby Hooper of all people? And who does he think he is?" Desecrating a classic, because this is 1986. Remakes were not a dime a dozen yet. If you were doing a remake, people were incredibly skeptical, and they would actually bring you to task, like, what are you bringing to this here, and who do you think you are?
On the other hand, I'm just skimming it right now, and it appears that the Nina Darton New York Times review is very complimentary. It says pretty much everything we have to say. You know, Karen Black is terrific.
Oh, shit.
They even, you know, give a nice freaking write-up of Louise Fletcher, for God's sake. I mean, it's just...
I do like when she says, David Gardner, I'm going to get you. Because it's something that someone in a child's nightmare would say. In your nightmare as a kid. That's accurate.
So, I mean, there you go. The preeminent reviewer. I mean, unless, what, Ebert shit on it. Oh, God. Right,
no doubt.
Hold on. Here we go. Let's see if he actually has it on his website. Okay. He didn't review it. Or if he did, he didn't include it.
Beneath his notice. I know he reviewed Chainsaw 2 and gave it 0 stars, which was a bit harsh. But
did he even do Life Force? I don't know if I believe that his website is comprehensive. Yeah, so... this is a good question. Like, what the hell? Like, no, the New York Times liked it. Like, you'd think that would have gotten some people to go see it. Like, it's the New York Times. Like,
yeah. No, I think half the people said you know, there's too many of these movies out there right now like this. And then the other half went, how dare they mess with the classic? And it was just a combination of derision and indifference.
And it's too bad. I mean, this one really deserves a lot more.
Yeah, it deserves to be, you can't even say rediscovered. It deserves to be discovered.
And hopefully it will get picked up on Blu-ray for something. And it's not like Hooper's, I don't think any of the principles are gone. Because, I mean, I think we said this, I've said this before with any canon movie we watch. It's like, you know that the making of documentaries, the most, it's, you know, just as good as the movie because it's going to be so crazy.
Actually, this did get a DVD release that included some vintage making of promotional thing, but it's probably just like a 10-minute fluff piece without much interesting stuff in it. But yeah, they did document it a little bit at the time. So, all right, well, that does it. So yeah, if you haven't seen Invaders from Mars, either version, check them out.
Yeah.
And, the Mars Madness will continue in a couple of weeks. We will be reviewing Red Planet and Mission to Mars, like we said. And y'all should come back now for that. So,
yeah, definitely, because we're not going to be as upbeat.
Yeah, we got some turgid sci-fi dramas to slough through, so come back for that, folks, and we will hopefully see you there. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt,
and this has been Andrew,
and thanks for listening.